The average single-family home in Madison is now valued at more than $424,000. It increased $47,000 in the last year alone, which is a 13% jump. And over the last 5 years, the average Madison home went up $124,000 in value, which is 42%.
Those are a lot of numbers, Scott. But you know what? I mean, what number is not as many as those numbers? People's wages are not going up as fast as the housing crisis. They're not keeping up pace. And that's especially true if people are renting, which is why we keep saying the editorial board that Madison is facing a serious housing crisis.
You don't have to take our word for it. On today's Center Stage with Milford and Hands, the Wisconsin State Journal's political podcast from the Sensible Center of Wisconsin Politics, we're going to play clips from our recent meeting with Kurt Paulson, a UW-Madison professor of urban planning. He's been teaching and studying about housing issues in the greater Madison area for most of the last two decades.
He calls this a housing crisis too, and he knows a lot more than we do. He's an urban planner. I just play one on TV. So he knows what's happening and what we can do about it.
I'm Scott Milford. I'm the opinion editor for the Wisconsin State Journal.
And I'm Phil Hands. I'm the editorial cartoonist for the Wisconsin State Journal.
And we are one-third of the Wisconsin State Journal editorial board.
The more in crisis one-third.
I thought you were going to say the more housed.
Well, I think we're all housed.
All right, that was a lot of numbers at the start. But the big number was $424,000. That's what a single-family home is valued at here.
What is this, New York City?
The increase in the last 5 years, I noticed, is about the same amount, $124,000, as I paid for my home 20 years ago in Madison.
Yeah, that was forever ago, Scott.
I guess, but what we learned from Kurt Paulson, and we'll play some of that in a bit, is that it's not just like it used to be, though. For example, I remember my parents telling me they bought their home in rural Wisconsin for $10,000. I've paid three times that for a car. So housing is always startling when you go from one generation to the next.
Yeah, when your parents bought their house, a candy bar cost a nickel.
But it's different now, is what Kurt Paulson tells us.
I think the level of increase in housing price, especially in attractive metro areas like Madison, Madison's very attractive. I mean, we have attractive people, but we're also attractive for, as a marketplace for people to move to. That just pushes up the value.
We asked Kurt, is Madison in a housing crisis? And as you referenced, he agreed. Here's what he said.
I think we are. But it's a different type of crisis. It's not like COVID or a financial crisis. It's a slow burning crisis. It's been building for years. And the truth is, most of us don't feel it. Because I refinanced my mortgage to 2.875% during COVID. I've lived in my house for 15 plus years. It's gone up in value. Like most homeowners, the answer is, what housing crisis? I'm doing fine. But employers will tell you there's a housing crisis. They can't find workers. Now, housing's not the only issue. I talk to economic development people around the state. It's always the same three things: housing, transportation, childcare. So it's a crisis certainly for those who earn less than $15 or $20 an hour. Service industry workers are being priced out. If you want the kind of example, the other day I was getting my hair cut and the two people working there, one lives in Baraboo and the other lives in Janesville.
And he was getting his hair cut in Middleton, by the way.
Personally, cut my hair last time was from New Glarus. People who aren't the highest earners, they just can't afford to live in Madison anymore. We saw this in the State Journal recently, where a couple of years ago we hired a brand new photographer, and her and her husband both had full-time jobs, and the closest place they could live that they could afford was Janesville.
And some people move out there for more home, but what Kurt said there resonates with me. My mortgage is something like $600 a month.
Oh, yeah.
If you don't count my property taxes, that's a whole nother issue in Madison. I mean, and I get a home for that with
yeah,
the yard.
Because you got in early.
And it's not increasing my cost. So for me, big deal. But what about my kids if they want to live here? What about young people who are coming in and going to enliven and bring creativity to our community? What are they going to do? Now, if they work for Epic, then they're going to live in one of the pricey apartment towers along East Washington Avenue or something like that. But there's a lot of young people that don't have those kind of jobs.
Yeah. I mean, your kids are going to live in your basement, Scott. That's where your kids are going to live when they come back to Madison.
Oh, it's not finished yet. That's why it was so cheap.
That's a project.
So we've been touting lots of things to do in editorials about the affordable housing crisis, from building more houses to building denser homes to helping people with their down payment, etc. There is another option Kurt mentioned.
Oh, yeah. What's that?
I sometimes say it jokingly that housing, this is not NASA. Failure is an option. You could just do what New York, San Francisco, LA have done and not build the housing for your workers, and then eventually you price people out and they move, or they commute 2 hours each way.
I don't like that option.
No, it's what's interesting is 20 years ago, New York, San Francisco, LA, they were these hot cities you moved to, and you could still find a place that wasn't affordable, but you could still move there if you weren't a gazillionaire. But now you can't. I mean, now this is not an option to live in San Francisco if you're not a gazillionaire. And Madison does not want to become that. San Francisco is failing as a city because number one reason is its housing prices is out of whack with what people can afford to pay for housing. You're pricing out workers. You're pricing out creative young people. You're pricing out all the things that make cities vibrant because the housing costs are out of control. And Madison needs to build a lot more housing to avoid that situation.
You asked Kurt whether Madison's an outlier. Here's what he said.
No, not an outlier. It's one of two most expensive markets in the state, but the median sales price for homes here is about what it is in Waukesha County as well. I always explain it to students this way, which is the price of housing in Boston or San Diego is twice what it is in Madison. And the price of housing in Madison is twice what it is in Wichita, Kansas, or Shreveport, Louisiana. So we're kind of in the middle. We're expensive for Wisconsin, and we're more expensive than we used to be. Back in the 90s, a middle-class family could buy a nice home in the Madison region and not have it be extraordinarily expensive.
Well, I should have pushed back on this because I'm not sure Madison isn't an outlier when it comes to a city of our size in the Midwest. Remember we had city council candidate Nina?
Yeah.
And she was complaining about housing prices in Madison. And she's like, I just lived in Chicago recently. And housing prices are more expensive here in Madison than they were in Chicago. And I had so many more services in Chicago. And Kelly Lecker, our editor, Kelly Lecker, when she moved from Columbus, was a shock for the cost of housing here in Madison. And she's moving from a big metro area like Columbus. So I'm not sure Madison isn't an outlier for a city of its size in the Midwest like we are. I think our tech sector is really bumping up our housing prices. But I'm not an expert like Kurt.
He talked about why things are so expensive here.
It's not only supply and demand, but supply and demand is a major factor.
Like any complex system, people want a story of a simple cause and effect, but it's a cumulative deficit between supply and demand over 15, 20 years. So at least in Dane County, since the housing and financial crisis of 2008, we've grown tremendously in terms of jobs, population, and housing. But the rate of growth of housing units is slower than the rate of growth of jobs and slower than the rate of growth of households. So we're adding more people, adding more households, but we're not building enough housing fast enough. So I estimate that deficit alone is 16,000 over the last 15 years, just to stay even with household growth, with demand. So we fall short about 1,000 units per year. Dane County does. That does not include the 40 to 50,000 people who live outside of the county and work inside the county. So we're short of everything. And when you're short of things, you get the squeeze in the middle and on the lower end. You talk to people, we're short of starter homes. We're short of condos. We're short of kind of larger rental units, like three bedrooms for families. And that's in the aggregate. And then you talk about any particular neighborhood or near a school zone where people want to locate or near a job center, and it just gets a greater crunch. So I say it this way. Housing is supply and demand. It's obviously much more than supply and demand, but it's not less than supply and demand. Because if you're short of units and you're adding people, vacancies go down, prices go up. And on the extreme end, that's what Boston and New York are. Our jobs housing balance in the county is about 1.35. You know, you want it closer to 1. In San Francisco, it's like 7. So there's more extreme cases than Madison.
We have heard some members of the city leaders say, hey, we're not going to build our way out of this housing crisis, which is true, but we're not going to get out of this housing crisis by not building a lot more housing. I mean, we have to build a ton more housing in Madison. That number of we're building 1,000 fewer units a year than we need to be building is really sort of earth-shattering. We're not making headway on making housing more affordable for people in Madison.
No, he said we're not catching up, even though we just had an election for mayor with the mayor touting that she's building a lot of units, not she, but she's approving, along with the city council, a lot of units, and that's true. But Madison's growing even faster than that.
We still see in Madison, you know, I was editing several letters to the editor this weekend for this weekend's page where people are complaining about new housing developments on East Washington. You know, people don't want more housing, but the city desperately, desperately needs more housing.
And if we don't get more housing, their values are just going to keep going up through the roof, which means higher property taxes.
If we have progressive values, that means we can't force working class people to pay through the nose for housing. We need to lower the cost of housing for working class people. And one of the best ways to do that is to just build more housing.
I asked Kurt whether we're catching up, and here's what he said.
Well, in the last year, in 2022, the building permits were down from 2021. Even though we need to build more housing, the other part of the problem is construction costs have gone up 35% since before the pandemic. So that means to build the same unit costs you 35% more just in terms of materials. Plus, there's a labor shortage. Plus, interest rates are higher. So if you look at 2022, when we had a huge housing shortage, we should be building more, but we're building slightly less. The Dane County numbers are starting to get back to what we would expect. So I would say we're kind of treading water in terms of the total units. So I realize this is a hard sell, right? Because we're saying take your best production year, turn it up to 11, and do that every year for the next 20 years just to keep up. Meanwhile, everyone, when they see me, whether at dinner or around, is like, why are we building all this housing? There's always new stuff going up everywhere. Who's actually living in those units?
Scott, I think what I've learned from this is that Madison needs a Spinal Tap solution.
Yes.
To our housing crisis. We just need a construction company that goes to 11 all the time.
I was going to give him credit for that too.
Yeah, I know, right?
One thing that isn't always easily defined is what is affordable housing. Is that housing for poor people? Is it housing for a teacher? Is it housing for upper middle class people? Maybe.
I mean, and how opposed should I be to it in my neighborhood?
We asked him specifically, what is affordable housing? Here's what he said.
Housing is considered affordable if a household spends no more than 30% of their income on housing costs. Then when we talk about affordable for whom, we're talking low and moderate income households. Most low-income renters acquire their housing on the private market without any subsidies at all. So only about 20% of low-income renters receive any housing assistance at all. So even though we can say that this unit is affordable to a household at this income level, the truth is that there's such short supply in the market. But there's a real problem with how we define affordability. All affordability is the ratio of the cost of housing to your income. But the cost of housing reflects quality. If what you can only afford is $900 a month, and that means that the unit you acquire is old and in a less than desirable location and it's far away from the schools, or your kids have to move the schools, it's not close to a bus stop, it doesn't have covered parking, and you don't have laundry in the unit. Compare that to a unit that's $1,400 a month, that's maybe in a better location, close to a bus, in better schools. Are you necessarily worse off by spending more for a higher quality unit? I use this example with my students. I'm going to sell you a car. It costs $5,000. Do you want to buy it? It's affordable for you. Do you want to buy the car? And you're thinking, what kind of a car is it? The biggest conundrum for us is that the price of housing reflects quality. And the quality of housing is often determined by its location. So people are willing to pay more to live closer to the bus stop, closer to good schools, closer to jobs, closer to downtown. So if we just focus on the price, what we're saying is what's affordable for you is to live in Janesville and drive 45 minutes,
right,
or to live in a really old unit that's run down. Since the vast majority of low-income households acquire their housing without subsidy, what we mean oftentimes by what in the business we call naturally occurring affordable housing,
right,
means it's less expensive because it's older and lower quality.
Right.
Or by the airport.
Or by the airport.
Or a highway.
Right. Or near a highway. Or in an older building that's very energy inefficient, or in a neighborhood that doesn't have good access to grocery stores and schools.
Or near an F-35, Phil.
So all of Madison should be less affordable. These F-35s are the best thing for our property taxes. I don't think housing is affordable because it's near a bus stop. Or housing is expensive because it's near – like, you know, those million-dollar homes in Fitchburgs, those aren't million-dollar homes because they're close to a grocery store and close to a bus stop. They're exclusive and far away from those things so that people who ride the bus aren't near them.
But those big towers of new apartments with swimming pools on them along East Wash, they're right on a bus line.
Yes, they are.
And they're expensive, and some of those young workers don't want a car or need a car. So there's some of that. I was surprised by the only 20% who could qualify for it get some sort of affordable housing subsidy. It sort of highlights, I think, the limits to what government can do and to some degree maybe the fairness of it.
Maybe it's highlighting the lack of imagination in government if only 20% of the people who really should be getting subsidies for housing are using them.
Or the lack of money, that there's only so much there.
We got so much money, Scott. We just raised the debt ceiling again. Come on.
One narrative that's common in Madison is that it's too picky, that we have the Landmarks Commission, the Urban Design Commission, neighbors.
Every neighborhood association.
That don't allow certain housing to go up, and then as a result, there's less housing. So we specifically asked him, is Madison too picky? And here's what he said.
The conversation about housing gets oftentimes very political, but I would say unambiguously that we know from the research that the longer you take the approval process for housing and the more requirements you add to it, you add to the cost. Yeah. I always say housing dies a death of 1,000 cuts. But I wouldn't say it's always picky, right? There's a difference between nitpicking the architectural color of the shingles versus making sure that traffic circulation on the site is there, making sure that, you know, that you have other sort of planning considerations. I mean, I'm going to try to avoid certain examples, but let's just say hypothetically that when apartments are proposed for a site and then people magically discover it's historical, that can tend to be perceived of as disingenuous, perhaps. Or, I mean, the problem is you don't build housing in a generic location. You build it in a neighborhood. And where do developers want to build housing? They want to build housing where people want to live.
Yeah.
And where do people want to live? Near jobs and schools and transit and parks.
Right.
But the problem is there's people already living there who don't want more housing to be built. So I wouldn't say picky. I would say you have to have a concern for the neighborhoods and for planning and the process. And in any particular instance, you might say, well, this makes sense. But the cumulative effect of design requirements and parking requirements and stormwater and delays and whittling down 4 stories to 3 stories and adding this and that, it adds to the cost. But we're not saying we want low quality housing in low quality neighborhoods just to make it less expensive. I wonder how many of the alders are going to be emailing me after if this is published like that. Right? I mean, because Madison is probably more extreme than most cities, which is very highly engaged public process.
Is that a factor in our high housing prices?
I wouldn't say it's the only factor. I would say it's much more the supply and demand issue. But it's the cumulative slowing down of the process that makes it harder to build here. Now, people would say, well, wait a minute, professor. Look at all the data. We're building tons of stuff already, so obviously the process is working. It's kind of a counterfactual, which is we don't observe the housing that's not built.
He's so diplomatic. Long story short, Madison is too picky, and
yeah,
that leads to us not building as much housing as we should. Prime example of this is the development near Tenney Park, which he sort of referenced mm-hmm. when he was talking about a sort of magical historical building showing up on that site. When it was finally run through the neighborhood association mm-hmm. and finalized, that project's got, I think, about 100 fewer units than it was originally proposed at.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you build those 100 other units? You know, that's serious loss in housing in Madison. And remember, we're building 1,000 fewer units every year than we should be.
And the forecast, he says, which we'll play now, it's not going to get any better.
We probably need over 100,000 new housing units between now and 2050. And that's probably on the low end of the forecast. And this is the conundrum, right? Because the big question is where? Because there's only 3 buckets you can build new housing in. The one is kind of incremental, small scale infill in established neighborhoods. We do that. The second is kind of redevelopment along these arterial corridors. We do that. And then the third is new neighborhoods on agricultural land on the outskirts, and we do that as well. And so the question is, of that 100,000, which how many are you going to put in each bucket? If every neighborhood says, oh, we're full, we can't take any more housing here, then the cumulative effect is going to be thousands of acres of agricultural prime farmland, and then you're forcing people to drive further distances because it's further on the outskirts of town. So it's a deep conundrum. And again, the other option, which is not desirable, is to just not build the housing. We have very successful companies and a regional economy. We're growing jobs at a very fast clip. This is a good thing, right? People are going to move here for jobs. And if someone moves here for a job and they earn $100,000, they might displace someone who earns $80,000. And they'll displace someone who earns $60,000. And so the person who earns $20,000 at the bottom is displaced or doubled up or moved out of the region. And this is the reverse field of dreams. If you don't build it, they still will come. This is where you get gentrification and displacement, because housing prices keep going up because people keep moving here. And this being Madison, I always want to say clearly, people moving here and jobs being created is a good thing. It's a good problem to have.
I like that he had to explain that in Madison, we have to remind people that having a strong economy and lots of jobs is in fact a good thing and not evil.
That's true. We try to remind people of that a lot. One solution we brought up that we've been excited about as an editorial board is giving developers more height and density than the city would otherwise allow in exchange for the developer making a certain number of their units affordable, meaning they're going to be less than market rate. He liked that idea.
So that's one of many good policies, I think, that Madison is doing given the constraints imposed by state law. It's an incentive-based. Under state law, in most places, you cannot mandate that a developer include affordable housing. You can certainly encourage and incentivize it. And Madison and Dane, other communities in Dane County have been really good at making sure that you partner with a developer who wants to apply for the affordable housing funding. You provide county funds, city funds, TIF, to make the finances work. And this is just another one of those incentives in the toolbox to make it pencil out. I think the biggest misperception people have is that developers are making obscene profits and you can just force them to provide affordable housing. But the math just doesn't work. Now, it costs the same dollar amount to build a new unit of market rate housing as it does affordable housing. And so you have to make that math work. And oftentimes it is nonprofits, and so that's part of how you make the math work. But you still have to pay the builders, you still have to borrow money, you still have to have operations and utilities and property taxes. And so Madison, I think, is doing a good job maximizing every incentive and dollar that they have. But of course, it feels like a small amount compared to the scale and scope of the problem.
One thing he underlined was that low-income people in people of color especially have a hard time affording housing in Madison because they don't make as much money on average.
In order for someone to buy a house and make it sustainable, which is, you know, you're buying a house in a neighborhood with stable or appreciating property value so that you can kind of build that wealth on the equity side, you have to have adequate income to support the mortgage, and then you have to have adequate savings for a down payment. So you really need to be removing all three of those barriers to build generational wealth. And Madison and Dane County has some of the lowest black homeownership rates anywhere in the country. It's abysmal.
I think what he said is reflective of what we heard at a lot of our candidate endorsement meetings during the spring election, is that we heard from a lot of the candidates of color, people like Isidore Knox on the south side, people like Sherry Carter on the south to southwest side.
Can we just have a moment of silence for Sherry Carter and what a tragedy that was that Madison didn't give her a job again? Because she's just the best alder we had.
But that's how families over time generate wealth, is by passing on things like homes.
Or the wealth from a home. I mean, both your parents and my parents owned their own homes. And when they sold their homes, they've made money off of their homes. And we've benefited from that wealth over generations.
If you're renting, you're never going to have that. And Madison, partly because of the university, but not just because the university, has a high number of renters.
You know, Madison is a small area on an isthmus. We need to build a lot more dense housing. You know, we don't have a lot of condos being built in Madison.
The good news is, apparently, Providing affordable housing is not rocket science, the good professor told us, including when you're trying to help improve equity.
This is not rocket science. We know what works in the research for low and moderate income homeownership and for Black and Hispanic homeownership. It's homebuyer education, counseling, plus down payment assistance. And then, particularly in an expensive market like Madison, that entry level of the housing ladder is really high. So it requires greater down payment assistance or extremely low interest mortgages or longer term mortgages.
Yeah, and one thing he mentioned was sort of just education. I mean, maybe that's something that the government could be doing was, you know, requiring more financial literacy at the high school level. I still think it's silly that, you know, kids know how to do advanced calculus when they graduate high school, but they can't figure out what their mortgage payment might be in the future.
Yeah, when I bought my home that 20 years ago, I got some help from WEDA, actually,
uh-huh.
the Wisconsin State Housing Agency, where they required that my wife and I go to a home buyer's class, which was very helpful.
Probably made you a better home buyer.
Yeah. And then they helped with the down payment to make that possible. And that was great.
Yeah,
and there's still programs out there, but you want to have lots of access to it. And one thing Kurt said is we all live in subsidized housing because of tax incentives and other things. He seem to really want to underline that point.
65% of households live in housing units that are owner-occupied. So the general rule of thumb is about two-thirds owner-occupied, one-third renter-occupied. And the biggest misunderstanding people have about housing policy, and I always use this with community groups or with my own students, which is I ask people, do you live in subsidized housing? And of course, nobody raises their hand, but that's wrong. I raise my hand because I live in subsidized housing. Far more dollars are spent on indirect tax subsidies for homeowners than for low-income renters. So as a federal government, we have a policy which is to subsidize upper-middle-class people to buy homes, but we do it indirectly through the tax code. And that creates this ratchet effect because you buy a home, it goes up in value, you think you're brilliant because you've invested and created value. Then someone wants to build affordable housing or any housing near you, and you have more of an incentive to say no or to try to thwart it. If we want housing to be affordable for everyone, then it can't keep growing in value for some.
One issue we don't have a clip on is that it's really hard to build condos these days. Even though all these buildings are going up, they're virtually all apartment buildings. And there's a bunch of bureaucratic reasons why it's hard to put up condos. But we did ask about the BRT and development along them. We do live in a city that's in the downtown is an isthmus, so there's a lot of room that we don't have housing because we have beautiful lakes. Well, other than when they're foul with green muck.
Yeah.
But here's what he said about that.
The other issue we haven't talked about is traffic, because if you bring in 100,000 new housing units and everybody drives at the same rate we drive today, you're going to be having to add 20 lanes to the Beltway and parking. And parking. And so the whole idea also of BRT and other transit is you build high capacity, high density with fewer parking requirements. We know in the transportation data that it's very hard to get a household to move from two cars to zero cars. It's a lot easier to get them to move from two cars to one car, where you use the car occasionally, you don't use it for everyday commuting. But, you know, in Madison, if you want to build housing with zero parking spots, you can do that now.
Yeah, you can.
And for young people, that lowers the cost of housing. You can hop on your bike or on the bus and
there are a bunch of bike paths.
Yeah. Yeah. Housing is a bundled good. So if you require parking to go along with the housing, that adds $300 to $400 to rent every month just for a parking space.
I mean, I think that is the ultimate goal of the bus rapid transit system, is to try and create more dense housing on the isthmus, more people get out of their cars. You know, we have 100,000 people coming into the city. We need 100,000 more units. I think a lot of city leaders would like to see more of those units be apartments in along the BRT lines in dense areas, and have it be a denser, more urban city in a lot along these transit lines.
Yeah, it seems like something that doesn't work for me. I feel like I've got to drive around to get kids to other communities for softball and are, if you're a reporter, you have to drive to a lot of events on short notice.
You got to get to this office in the middle of nowhere down on the south side of Madison where there's no bus lines that really go here.
It's a long commute if you want to try to use public transportation. But that only underscores how we need better public transportation. And the other thing is, when they were going to build that cool boutique hotel down in that first block by the Capitol on State Street, those guys brought up that they really didn't need much parking at all for their hotel.
That's what the market research said, was that people weren't interested in a lot of parking for the hotel.
And actually, they had had a hotel, I think it was out in Seattle, but it was on the West Coast somewhere. And they had data from that to show that a lot of people, particularly young people, just don't need a car, don't want a car. And when they come to Madison, they don't rent a car either.
Yeah, well, I'm going to Chicago this weekend, and I'm really annoyed that I have to pay to leave my car in a garage downtown all weekend. I'd rather not have to drive my car to Chicago.
Well, can't you just take the high-speed train to Milwaukee and then go to... Oh, no.
Oh, no. Thanks, Scott Walker.
One development that Madison did allow...
The one and only.
That we're going to write about in an editorial, Sequoia Commons on Midville Boulevard, which when that was proposed, the neighborhood thought it was going to destroy the neighborhood like Godzilla. And it's such a great thing now. I've stopped there. There's a library. There's a pizza place. There's ice cream and coffee. You can walk there. And we did ask him about the backlash sometimes that neighborhoods have to communities and particularly that Sequoia Commons. Isn't that a great example of what Madison needs more of? More density. Sequoia Commons actually does have some condos. It has apartments. And it has lots of cool things that people want to do. And it used to be a parking lot.
It's never as bad as the neighbors say. And I've been on plan commission and been at city council for years. And it's never as bad as the opponents say. And then after a few years, they move on. And people are like, oh, that's pretty nice. I mean, I guess this comment might get the hate mail to start flowing. But I would want all of my friends and neighbors to stop calling a five-story building a tall building. this is a city, for God's sake.
Amen to that. And by the way, cities have sidewalks too. Totally different issue, and that raises the cost of housing.
Oh my gosh. Sidewalks and height are the two most...
But please... this is a city.
Yeah, one of the best things about Sequoia Commons is that it helps the entire neighborhood. It makes that entire neighborhood walkable, which is something that everyone wants. We need a Sequoia Commons and we need more Sequoia Commons across Madison so that more neighborhoods are more walkable, because that's what our new homeowners want, is a neighborhood where they can walk to a coffee shop. They can walk to a bar. That's good for the drunk driving numbers. People can walk to a bar. That's very good. Cities have density. Cities have traffic. Madison needs to stop pretending we're a little tiny town.
Even with the height limit within a mile of the state capitol, there's a lot of room to grow, and there's plenty of room outside of that area to grow too. It's just... We need to be more open to housing, even if it's in our neighborhood, even if it's by us, so more people can enjoy Madison just like we have, and so it doesn't become San Francisco.
And I'm going to say something here, and this isn't Kurt Paulson saying, this is me saying this, Phil Hands the cartoonist, but opposing new housing is the least progressive thing you can do. You're opposing other people having access to affordability and a healthy lifestyle in order to protect your wealth. I mean, it is the most selfish, unprogressive thing that people can do in Madison is to oppose new housing projects, because this is what's going to keep our housing values down. It's what's going to make the city more affordable to the people who really need help. And, you know, if it hurts your housing, you know, your property values, you know, that's – who cares? Let me ask you, just to test our age here, how much was your first apartment in Madison?
I believe I paid $140 a month.
$140 a month, wow.
As a college student at UW Madison. But it was in a house with seven people, and I shared a room. And what we didn't know at that tender age was the utility bill was going to be enormous, because the house was a sieve.
Oh, yeah.
We thought it was a mansion, but our parents thought it was a shithole.
Yeah, where was it?
end of Bassett Street.
How
about you?
My first apartment, when I first got my internship here at the State Journal, it was less than $400 a month, and this was 2004. And it was, I had my own room. It was a studio apartment in the ugliest building in Madison. Like, it was on West Wilson Street, and you drive past all these cool Victorian houses. I'm like, oh, I'm going to be in this little apartment in the back of this house. No, it's just a story and a half cinder block building that's got, you know, crappy studios in it.
What's the name of it?
I don't remember the name of it. It was on West Wilson Street. It's the ugliest building in Madison. If you blink, you'll pass it. It was nasty. And then when I moved back in 2005, my wife and I got this really nice apartment on Franklin Street for $900 a month. And that did not include utilities, but it did have its own washing and drying machine in the basement.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Fancy.
We were living the fancy life for $900 a month.
Our theme music is by Tube Tester.